Pod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode 560, and joining me today is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going?
It's going pretty good, Derek. Can't wait to talk some racing with you.
Yeah, we got a lot to talk about in this show. We're just going to be covering Le Mans, as there was quite a bit that happened, as well as hit some news topics. We got some listener feedback we're going over, so it's going to be a packed show. Lots to go over.
Okay. Well, the first thing is, we got a little listener feedback here. Got this off of the Motopod fan page at facebook.com/Motopod. It's a question from Sean Phillips, and Sean asks, a question for Rapid Fire or for Jim's Corner. What is on GP and Superbikes that holds the wheel in line with the axle holes when the tires are changed? I can recall a shot from the Moto3 grid in Argentina where a mechanic is changing a tire on the grid. He lifts the rear wheel easily into place, and it stays there while he calmly inserts the axle. How's that done? It would make swapping tires in my garage and at track days so much easier. Well, Sean, thanks for writing in, and basically this is how it works. In your typical street bike, you have basically two chain adjusters that slide into the swing arm of the motorcycle, and you tighten those to pull the rear axle forward or backwards to loosen or tighten the chain as required. Then, between the swing arm and the wheel bearing is a spacer that's generally machined down. It fits inside of the inner race of the wheel bearing, and it fits in though into the hub of the wheel. Then you pull that up, you lift it up, center it between the swing arm, and you can slide the axle through. What they do for MotoGP and for Superbikes and for like World Endurance is they take that spacer basically out of the equation. So what they do is they build a spacer that fits sort of into the chain adjuster of your street bike. It's obviously a round cylinder, but then as it mates up to the inside of the swing arm where the rear tire is, it's a square chunk of metal that they then machine a U-shaped slot into. Now, they change your spacer on your rear wheel. They take it and they machine it into a spacer that looks kind of like your hand grip on your motorcycle, a smaller cylinder followed by a much larger cylinder. Now that larger round cylinder, like where your hand would be against the hand grip, then slides into or rolls up that little U-shaped piece of metal that's sitting on the swing arm. Therefore, when the mechanics take the bikes and the race bikes, they pick up the wheel, you'll see them, they kind of set it up in there and then they kind of push it or roll it forward. That's actually rolling those spacers through that U-shaped slot, and it puts it in there. Then that they just put a hand against it or a knee that holds the tire in place. It's perfectly in line with the axle. They slide the axle in and torque it back down. So if you have access to a lathe and a Bridgeport mill and some good high quality aluminum, you could easily make yourself a set and do the same thing that they're doing. So there you go, Sean, there's your answer.
Well then, that was very informative, even for me. I would have liked to know that this weekend when I was changing two sets of tires on a motorcycle. Yeah, some great feedback from Sean there. Yeah, unless you have anything else I want to go over with that, we can jump into the news.
No, we'll go right to the news. Sad thing for me, 1 year ago today exactly, because we're recording on the 22nd, Nicky Hayden died as a result of injuries sustained when he was hit by a car while he was on his training on his bicycle. Very hard for me to let Nicky go. It hurts anytime someone dies racing a motorcycle. It doesn't matter where it is. I miss Simicelli. I miss all the guys that have gone before us. Tommy Zawa too. Nicky hurts a little bit more for me personally because I knew Nicky from when he was a kid. I raced dirt track against him, road race against him. So it's a little bit harder for me to take.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to think that it's been a year already. I remember I had the day off. I think it was like a Monday or something. And like I saw the news and I was like devastated. You know, I think as Americans, like, you know, Nicky was our like shining spot in MotoGP and on the world stage. And you know, I was lucky enough to meet him a couple times and, you know, have my autograph doodads as well. But like, yeah, definitely hard, but, you know, it's important to remember, like, I think with any sporting hero, like, just remember, like, all the emotions that comes along with. So in 2006, you know, when he won that title, even just watching it back, it's like one of the most, like, like just pure emotion that you see in any sporting event. So in everything, therefore, like, he seemed like he was well respected in the paddock for just being a great guy. So yeah, definitely hurts.
And another bit of BSB news. Shaky Byrne had a crash in a private test at Snetherton. So I got with Dave Neal, got some information on him. He is the reigning BSB expert here at Motopod. He says that Shaky actually had to crash at turn three at Snetherton. It was only on like his third lap of the day. Turn three is a positive camber left-hander that's almost 90 degrees, and Dave says it's rare to see anyone actually crash there. Shaky was knocked unconscious, tended to trackside for 15 minutes before being transferred to the med center and then on to Norwich and later Norfolk Hospital. Reportedly, he has broken bones in his back and his neck, along with a broken breastbone and the majority of his ribs. He did have a successful operation yesterday to fix some damage, but there's very little official information out there about exactly what damage he has and what operations have been done. He does remain in critical care, but is conscious and alert, and it is hard to say what his future holds, but it seems as though his season is over this year.
Yeah, that's pretty tough news. I was making the rounds on Twitter and stuff, and you know, as we don't really have too much BSB and coverage here in the States, you know, it was kind of, you know, when I saw that, I was like, you know, I wasn't really sure what was going on, just because there was so little information coming out. But even just today, it looks like, yeah, you know, Shaky's family put out a message saying everything, all the surgeries were as successful as they could be. So we'll see. But I mean, that's tough, you know, the BSB champ from last year, and, you know, making the championship really interesting this year. That's definitely a bummer. Hopefully he recovers quickly.
On a happier note, Andrea Dovizioso has celebrated a new two-year agreement with Ducati, which will see him ride on the red bikes in the factory team for 2019 and the 2020 seasons. I don't think that was too much of a surprise. I don't think Dovizioso really wanted to go anywhere else. I just think he wanted to get money that was on par or closer to what Lorenzo was getting.
Not a shocker that Dovizioso is back there. Definitely really glad to see him back there. It's nice to know he's getting paid the right amount, but you know, there's been tons of talk already. Even at Le Mans, you know, Paolo Chiabatti was pretty frank, being like, we can't pay what Lorenzo wants. So they're really looking at Jack and Danilo, and so we'll see what that holds. But I'm super happy that Dovi's back in red next year. It's going to be good. One piece of news that I don't know if we got in here is Alex Rins, or it's probably covered on the last one, but one thing I want to know is Alex Rins was confirmed at Suzuki for next year. And Jim, I believe that makes us 1-1 so far.
That's true.
You had Zarco, I have Rins.
Very true, my friend. I was going to congratulate you on that. No, actually, I purposely left that out of the notes just to mess with you. No. But yes, you said it. You called it. You were correct. I will bow to that.
So we'll see who's going to end up at Suzuki next year, though. There's been a lot of mutterings that Mir's going to one factory, then he's going to the other factory. Honda, Suzuki. So we'll see what info we have by the time Mugello rolls around. But that next seat, that's the next one on the scoreboard. I still have Lorenzo at Suzuki, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know what to think about Mir going there. I could see him going for maybe 1 or 2 years. That then begs the question, in my mind, what is Honda going to do? Because Honda, if you look back sort of historically, they generally do not pull rookies into their team. Okay, the exception was Marc Marquez, but my gosh, people, if you could not see that one coming, you were blind. Because, I mean, they got the rookie role rescinded so they could have that kid on their motorcycle.
Historically, though, they do a fair amount of rookies. If we look all the way, you know, let's start at Rossi. That was his first team in the Premier class. Hayden, they pulled right from AMA.
Wasn't Rossi riding on a satellite Honda? He was not on the factory Repsol Honda the very first year he rode. He had backing from Nastro Azzurra, the beer company. So it might have been a factory bike, but it was not in the factory team.
All right. Well, we look at Nicky. They pulled him right from AMA. We look at Danny. Danny's been there forever, but he came right, even though he was a double world champion, he still hopped right on there. Stoner
True.
Was the odd
True.
Man out.
I think I was getting confused with the Stoner thing, and I was confused with, like, the Doing thing.
So
and
it's not unprecedented, but I do have to say, I do like Mir there at Honda way better than I like him at Suzuki, and I think, I mean, obviously it just comes down to how many zeros are at the end of the check, but I would want to see him at Honda way more than I'd want to see him at Suzuki, because I think they're going to make the Maverick Vinales mistake where he's there for 2 years and then he's off again.
That's very possible. The question is what they do with Pedrosa. Danny's the sort of the perfect teammate to Marquez, and I, you know, if Mir goes there, my one fear is that if Mir goes directly 1 year of Moto to directly to MotoGP, he may not be big bike seasoned enough, maybe, because even Marquez spent 2 years in Moto 2.
Yeah, it's just because he missed out on the title, and there wasn't anywhere to put him. But I don't know. I think while Moto 2 and like the amount of Moto 2 riders on the grid now is good, I think it ultimately comes down to that. It's just that intermediate step. They could put them on 600s. They could like stock 600s or like literally any other bike, and then make that move to MotoGP. And there's the rider is always going to progress. Like I don't think Moto 2 is necessarily the best step to get there. Like look at Vinales. Look at Miller. Look at Rins. Rins had, did he have one or two seasons? I think he may have had two. But even still, like, I don't think it's all that, you know, important that they get that Moto 2 experience because the rider's just going to adapt to what they're on. I will say, like, it does definitely give you time to improve your racecraft in your riding. Look at Zarco, obviously, double Moto 2 world champion. But then you also look at Tom Lüdi. And, you know, just because you're there for longer doesn't mean you're going to get any better. So if you spot that talent early, I think getting them up to the top class as soon as possible makes as much sense. So I'm not, I honestly don't think that should be a huge concern for Mir.
We shall see. It remains to be seen what happens. But Jack Miller says that he's getting a factory GP19, no matter factory seat or not, he gets a 2019 motorcycle, which... Interesting statement from Miller. Does that foreshadow his movement to the actual factory team? I would think Petrucci would have something to say about that because he came out at the beginning of the year and said, I have a contract that says that I get it, that if anybody leaves the factory team, I get that factory seat. Not that Petrucci doesn't, in my mind, deserve to at least give it a try. Interesting statement from Miller.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, though, because, like, you know the Pramac team is going to be Jack and Pecco, and with Jack doing as well as he has been doing this year so far, that, you know, he's going to get the Petrucci treatment, and he's going to be the number one rider on that satellite team, so he's going to have the same year factory bike as the current factory rider. So I think that makes sense for Miller to come out and say that. He does have a shot, you know, if Lorenzo doesn't continue with Ducati, if Petrucci gets more money from Aprilia or another factory and ends up going there, you know, it's a realistic possibility. I think it's a very outside possibility. Like if Lorenzo doesn't go, I don't see Petrucci not getting that factory ride. But yeah, I think Jack saying that is, it shouldn't come as a shock because I think one way or the other, he's going to have that.
Yeah, I think he's sort of Tardozzi's sort of favored son.
Yeah, definitely in those interviews, he's much more enthusiastic about Jack than he is Lorenzo. So we'll see.
That's for sure. Also in MotoGP news, reigning MotoGP champion Marc Marquez and his teammate Danny Pedrosa are going to test the Red Bull Formula One car. Should be interesting to see what comes of that. And I'm sure this will spark all sorts of rumors that we had with Rossi that once Marquez hangs up his racing leathers, he's going to go put a fire suit on and drive for Formula One and win a title on four wheels. But that's just all rumor and hearsay. I just think it'd be cool. It'd be interesting to see what Marquez can do on four wheels as opposed to two.
Yeah, I think Lorenzo had a test a couple years ago in the Mercedes. I think it's cool just to see them on on the others' machines. I think Alonso had a ride on the Honda the other year. So I'm always pumped to see that just because, but I think the only one that had real validity was Rossi going to Formula One way back in the day, but that's long gone. So yeah, well, that's cool. I didn't realize Pedrosa was also driving that car. I wonder if they put like extension pedals on it for him. You can reach.
Ooh, that's mean.
No, they're all that small. The Formula One drivers, the MotoGP riders, they're all like jockeys, so they're all going to be tiny.
So private testing happened at Barcelona on the Tuesday after the races at Le Mans. Basically, it was a test to gather and evaluate tires and get data on the new track surface. It's interesting to also note that the track will now return to the original penultimate corner and will not use the F1 chicane as they had the previous year.
Wait, really?
That is what I read in the tire testing, and it was on crash.net. So take that for what it's worth, but they're saying they're going back to the original layout, and they're not going to use the F1 chicane.
So what, last year they ended up using two chicanes, right? They like started with the Formula One chicane, and then they made like a different MotoGP chicane. So are they just going to be using that one, or are they doing the like real final turn?
Okay, as I remember last year, not last year, but the year before, so not the 2017 race, but the 2016 race, they used the Formula One chicane, which I would call a larger chicane, if you will.
Yeah.
They came in 2017 and they made another cross through sort of halfway between where they made the hard turn into the chicane and where the exit is on the Formula One cars. So it was sort of a hybrid chicane that was made to be like a little quicker, a little faster for the motorcycles. That wasn't liked by the riders, and I fail to remember why they didn't like it. But on the morning of, they switched back and decided to run the actual Formula One chicane. Now, whether they've moved some of the barriers, added a bigger gravel trap, I do not know at that turn, but I'm going with what the news was, that they're going back to the original layout.
Well, they were supposed to have a test today, and that got rained out, so I guess we'll see what they run tomorrow, and that should shed some more light on that, yeah?
I would think so. So the last bit of news that I have here is that after the Argentina start debacle with Jack Miller being the only man on the grid, apparently the FIM has come out with the new procedures that are going to apply to the racing there. So basically, trying to boil this all down is a little tough. If a rider changes his bike before you do the warm-up lap, so if you were to go out on the siding lap, you decide you want to change, you could come in, you could change your bike, and you could then go out to your qualifying position and start the race from there, but then you would get a ride-through penalty to make up for the time difference caused if you were to stop during the race and actually make a change to your bike. So this allows you to get so that nobody has to worry about juggling where you're going to be on the grid, makes it for a nice, soft, safe start, and there is no start delay. If you were to change a bike after the warm-up lap, then you would change, and that means that you would exit and then you would have a ride through penalty as well. So you would start the race, you know, we go to the siding lap, you know, we're coming back to the grid, there's only a few seconds before the lights turn green, you dive into the pits, you change your bike, you'd roll up to the end of pit lane, you would stop there, you would wait, you would go and proceed as the start after all the bikes had gone, then you would come do a ride through penalty there as well. Now, if there's a mass pit lane start, if more than 10 riders make any kind of change from the warm-up lap or the siding lap and they're all in the pit lane, they will then be allowed to start from pit lane, but they will line up in the order in which they got to the end of the pit lane. They will all then be single file all the way back to the 10 riders that are in that line, and then they will be allowed to go after the race starts, and then they will take off following pit lane procedure, which is you cannot pass until you get to the blend line on the racetrack. Then you would, each one of them would have to come through and do a ride-through penalty. So they would do that. So these rules are all there. The only other thing is if you had more than 10 riders go in, you would then basically go to a quick start procedure. Everybody would change bikes. Everybody would go to the grid then where they were, and then they would start the race and everybody would take off because essentially the race has wouldn't be affected because you've had so many people go into the pit lane to change. you basically just start the race anew, which is kind of like what would happen in Argentina. If you want to, you guys can read it for yourself, but that's the general gist of what's happening. So look for those rules to be implemented at the Italian GP if in any case it does rain or we have a wet to drying or drying to wet type track situation.
The ruling makes sense. I mean, you know, just because Jack got boned for making the right tire choice. But, you know, yeah, if you go into the pit lane and everyone's in there, you know, happen to do that ride through, essentially would have given Jack that 30-second advantage to the whole field, and he should have won that race besides for the whole Mark thing. But smart thinking, convoluted how it has to be explained, but that's just because it's a very cumbersome procedure. Yeah, hopefully we don't have to see that for a while, even though it does make for some exciting stuff. I think what the last time that would have been applicable was Sachsenring back in 2014, 15.
Yeah, somewhere close to there. I think it was maybe 15.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, anyway, that's about all we had for news. Let's get on to the Moto3 qualifying, shall we?
So Moto3 qualifying, just to kind of go through it relatively quickly, it was a crash fest, basically. Rodrigo had a crash. Bastianini had a high side that was there. Yurchenko was down. Bezucci was down. McPhee went down. And that was all before we got to like the final 10-minute dash that was going on. There was a combination of low sides and high sides. A lot of people were crashing at turn 3 and turn 7, which are difficult turns at Le Mans just because the tires cooled off or whatever. But with 10 minutes to go, the leaderboard looked like this. It was Bastianini, Arenas, Ramirez, DiGiantonio, Antonelli, Canet, Arboretto, Martin, Bezecchi, and Migno. That was how this was going down. As the final 10 minutes wound off, basically Martin had fallen down to 10th. He had been surpassed by Ortel, who had jumped to 8th. With a few seconds left, Martin came in and jumped from 10th all the way to 1st, which was pretty amazing. He then held on to that position as Kornfeld, on the very last go-around, wound up jumping from his position all the way up to 2nd on there. So a lot of drama happening there in the last two laps as everybody was looking for the toe and coming around there. But that is how things went down in Moto3 qualifying. If you have anything you'd like to add, Derek?
No, I mean, we see Martin on pole was not a surprise whatsoever. I think the fact that Canet at least made a lunge for it was nice. You know, he could have literally just used that entire session as a race run for him because he had to start at the back anyway. But nothing really too shocking Moto3 qualifying. Martin just has a ton of watches now. We'll only assume he's going to get more as the year goes on. And I think this one tied, or he's just shy of the most poles in Moto3, except by Rins right now. So that's definitely going by the end of the season.
So your top 10 from qualifying: Jorge Martin, Kornfeld, Bastianini, Ramirez, Arenas, Bezecchi, Antonelli, DiGiantonio, Migno. Canet wound up in 10th. However, he will go to the back of the grid to serve the penalty that he was given for the incident in Jerez. So that kind of does it for Moto3 qualifying.
Moto2 qualifying, I wouldn't say was all that much more interesting per se. What stood out to me is kind of the struggles of KTM. Looking at last year, it makes sense, but just to see them so far behind still. What you had Oliveira qualifying in 10th, and another poor qualifying session for him. And then he had Binder in 8th, so a little bit better for him. He had Sam Lowes up in 7th. Again, nothing really was indicative of what looked to be their race pace. So that was, I guess, not shocking to me, just looking back at last year's race and how much they struggled at Le Mans. That was interesting, but no surprise here. We had Benyaya, you know, take the pole position. We had Chevy Viehi in 2nd place on the front row, which was awesome to see. To have a Calix this year, he's really showing what he can do. So that was awesome to see. You had Baldessari come from out of nowhere. He was struggling in all the free practice sessions. And then he just pulls out this lap out of nowhere. And then in his interview, he's like, oh yeah, you know, we changed some things. And finally, like on the last run, like he just shoots like such a fast lap. So that was interesting as well. And then you had Mir in 4th. So that was, I think, his best qualifying so far. You knew that he was going to make a play for the podium. It was a good Moto2 qualifying. I wouldn't say it was, again, particularly interesting. The track in general all weekend was very crash heavy. I don't know if it was down to just the temperatures, but it seemed like it was warm there, or, you know, the grip that the track was offering. But Yeah, definitely a lot of crashers. I think Manzi had what it was four crashes in turn seven throughout the entire weekend.
It was a crash fest. There's no doubt about that.
But yeah, shout out to Joe Roberts, qualified in 17th,
Did very well.
better than like 27th, where he's normally been starting.
There looks like they're making progress.
Yeah, and then they're getting more updates before Barcelona, I think, on that bike. So that's going to be interesting too. But yeah, that's about it for Moto2 qualifying for me.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that, it was a crash fest. Again, everybody seemed to be falling everywhere. Lowe's had two falls in the session. As you mentioned, Baldessari had that huge jump up the field. Vierge, he was strong all weekend. All throughout practice sessions, he was definitely near at or near the top in all of them. Definitely looking for good things for him out of the race. And, like I said, Robertson 17th, the NTS looking good. So just quickly, the top 10, Bagnaia, and then followed by Vierge, Baldessari, Mir, Marcel Schroeder with that still broken scaphoid bone in his left shoulder looked good in fifth. Marquez then starts in sixth on the second row. Lowe's, even despite the two crashes, is seventh. Binder was there in eighth, and then Simone Corsi in ninth, and Oliveira, the other KTM, in 10th. The other interesting thing too was that there was only two people in the last 10 minutes that really changed their position. That was Baldessari, who jumped up to third. And then Brad Binder had jumped up to eighth. Other than that, no one really moved. All the fast times were set very early on in that session, which was interesting. Usually it's that last 10 minutes or so when things get crazy, but not this time.
Yeah, so that about wraps it up for Moto2, and we can jump into Q1 for MotoGP. There's some big names that are normally not in Q1, and especially Danny and Cal. After last week in Jerez, everyone starting on all the Hondas on the front row. You're like, oh man, the Hondas made a step. Like this is it. They're always gonna just like kill it. That was clearly not the case. You also had Danilo, who was a pretty normal charger from Q1, but if he's in Q1, he normally moves into Q2. So, it's really those three riders to watch for in my eye.
The story, I think, is the absolutely massive high side that Crutchlow has. It looked like old school 500 flick you kind of a thing. He got into the corner, he was in deep, and he started to crack the throttle on. And I think he just expected it just to spin up and square the corner off. And it started that way. The back end starts to swing out, and suddenly it just caught grip in an instant. And it just flicked poor Cal over the top, and he came down so hard on, I think it was his right side, and he just landed right square on his hip pelvis. And when he landed, I even went ouch, and I thought, oh, Cal didn't get up right away. And I mean, Cal is a man of steel. He's like Superman, and he did not just jump right back up again. And I thought, oh, I thought for sure he had either had maybe broken his pelvis or had broken a leg or something. He was then, he was put on the old backboard and taken by the medical people to the trackside facilities. He was looked at there at Clinica Mobile, and then he went to the actual hospital or whatever. At this point in time, it was in doubt as to whether Crutchlow was actually going to race on Sunday. After Crutchlow's crash, really, it's what you expect. Petrucci and Pedrosa both went through into the Q2 session, but a big shout out to Hafe Sairin. He was fourth in the session, which I think shows great improvement for Hafe, and he has definitely been nothing but progressing up and up, and he's getting faster and better. And it wouldn't surprise me to see in the next couple races maybe see Hafe make it directly through, or make it into Q2, or maybe even go directly to Q2. That's what I'm taking from Q1.
Yeah, so basically the session ended up getting red flagged. Got Petrucci and Pedrosa moving on, which again, not a shocker. And then Q2 was fairly interesting as well. Ended up being Frenchman on pole. I think that's the biggest highlight and what got everyone excited. French rider, French team, pole position, French Grand Prix. That was amazing to see.
It was the first time since 1988 when Christian Siron sat on pole. So that was pretty exciting for Zarco to do that. It was definitely calm until we hit that second run where everybody kind of came back out and was going to give it one last great big go. Marquez kind of had gone to pole. Zarco came by and just obliterated that. He was just absolutely insanely fast. He had made some comment about seeing the time that Marquez had put up, and he thought, well, I'll have to try to beat that. And then he just put his head down and beat it significantly. And then in that last go-round, Marquez tried to beat it. He was definitely working hard at it, but he had two large moments on that last try to make it happen, and it just fell short. So he would wind up starting the race in second. You know, Petrucci, who came out of the first qualifying session, wound up third. He just kind of quietly snuck in there. You just didn't realize that he was actually even there until the very end. And then he was followed by Iannone, who was having another very good qualifying session on the Suzuki. He was looking very good on it. After that, you had Dovizioso and Lorenzo and Miller next. So you had three Ducatis in there. And after that, it was Vinales, who was in eighth, which was the Yamaha starting to actually come good. After their success at Jerez, they kind of slid backwards a little bit. And Rossi was also back there in ninth. Pedrosa finished up in 10th.
Yep, so that was Q2. You know, I think seeing Danilo come through and start on the front row, it's pretty impressive. You don't really see that too often, so that was pretty exciting to see. Then we moved on to Sunday.
Can I add one thing about qualifying for the Yamaha?
Yeah.
Just real quick. There is an article by Matt Oxley. It's talking about the next electronics ban in MotoGP, and it's talking about the IMU, which is the inertial motion unit, and basically the gyroscopes that are on the bikes that basically tell the bike how hard it's accelerating and how much lean it has, et cetera, et cetera. Well, those are all customized to each bike. They're written by Honda or Yamaha or Ducati, and then they have to plug into the standard Magneti Marelli system. Well, people are believing now that Honda and Suzuki and Ducati all have a way where they're sort of bypassing the standard electronics of the Magneti Marelli system, or helping the Magneti Marelli system work better by using some of the processing power and doing some of the thought process in the IMU unit. So some now have speculated that the up and down cycle and curve of Yamaha is based on the fact that they haven't figured out how to manipulate their IMU unit and their gyroscopes and accelerometers to help think for the Magneti Marelli unit, and that could be why they are sort of up and down on the grid. It's a very technical, in-depth read. I suggest you go look at it. It's a interesting fact, and it's the only thing that kind of actually makes sense with Yamaha being so up and down. We can now move on to the racing.
At Moto 3, holy dear Jesus, this was drama.
It was a good race.
It was a good race, as any Moto 3 race should be and normally is. It was tight at the front. There was a number of fallers throughout the race. Where to start?
We can start at the beginning. You know, Martin, he grabbed the whole shot. Mazzacchi had an absolutely great save at the Dunlap curve. He came out of the seat. And then Martin and Kornfeld kind of looked like they were just pulling a bit of a gap there at the front. Martin had a very hard move on Kornfeld. It was fair at Dunlap, but that's how racing in Moto 3 actually is. So then the battle behind kind of got themselves together. Bacecchi, DiGiantonio, Bastianini, Ramirez, they all sort of kind of got together, kind of started using the draft on the long back stretch in that front straightaway there at Le Mans to kind of catch back up. And so they all kind of came together there at the front. What really gets interesting is that we start getting a bunch of time penalties start showing up. Kornfeld wound up getting a 1.3 second penalty for track limits because everybody seemed to be sort of cutting the chicanes or cutting across the lines of the chicanes. Antonelli then got like a 1.8 time second penalty, which I'm like, if you're going to give a time penalty, how do you know that it's 1.3 seconds versus 1.8 seconds?
They can probably take like their average lap time or the lap time of the riders around them and see if they gained an advantage. And if they did, just subtract that. That's how I would assume they do it.
I would think, though, that it would be just simpler to say, like, look, guys, if you're going to cut the chicane, each of you gets a 10-second penalty or something added to your time. I am not in favor of adding time to somebody's race time. I don't like that because it's very difficult as you're watching it to try to now figure out where is everybody, because this person has 1.8, this has got 1.3. If you're going to exceed track limits and you guys are going to call it and say, hey, look, you can't go across the curves, you can't cut this, you can't cut that, then give them a black flag and make them have a ride through.
What?
That's easier to take care of. It's much easier for the fans who are watching to understand who's out front and find out who or why has a penalty, as opposed to, well, you just randomly get 1.3 and you get 1.8. That's how I see it.
I think they're trying to make it fair for the teams and stuff at the same time. So it's not a 30-second penalty, so it's not going to ruin their race for cutting a corner, but they are going to get penalized to a degree. I was just watching the Northwest highlights, and when they cut the chicane, they have to stop, They have to put their foot down and they have to keep going. And, you know, even that is like, you know, sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't. It's like, man, like, what are you doing? Yeah, I can understand from a fan's perspective, it can get a little confusing. But for the teams and for the organization of it all, I think it does make sense to have those, like, times. I think it would be much easier to just be like, oh, you can just give them a 5-second penalty if you cut any chicane or if you cut any time frame. And then, you know, that would be a little bit easier for the fans to digest and, you know, a little bit harsher for the teams. But I can see where they're going with this.
I'll give you that. But what was interesting then is after we got all these time penalties was that De La Porta went down at turn 8. It looked like he'd caught like a false neutral. Like he had a box full of nothing and he was trying to find the right gear and just sort of ran off and wound up putting it down into the gravel trap. But the fight was at the front. It was basically Martin versus Bisecci. And they were back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And every time Martin just turned into a demon on the brakes, as soon as they got to a straightaway, Bisecci just flew by with that KTM. I think they said that they came out with like a new cylinder head and new exhausts for the KTM, and whatever acceleration or top end speed deficiency that they had on Honda, they've got Honda now by bunches. Even from the helicopter, you could see Bisecci would just pull away from Martin by at least a bike length on the straightaways. It was pretty amazing. But it was getting to the point where Martin was just getting braver and braver and braver on the brakes, because every time he'd stuff it in there, Bisecci would just blow past him again. And I got the feeling right then that something crazy was going to happen between those two. Because as a rider, when you get a guy who's got more horsepower than you and he's pulling away from you on the straights, you just want to ride so much harder and go so much deeper onto the brakes, because that's the only way you can make up the time. And you want to open the throttle just that little bit quicker than him, because you want to try to get out there and try to stay tied up in that draft. And Martin was just riding so hard that you just felt, it just felt like there was something amazing going to happen. And then, voila, the absolute chaos and franticness of the last two laps of this race come in. And we'll start with, they're at the end of the penultimate lap. They're going through turn 13 into 14 and onto the front stretch. And basically what happens is that Bastianini winds up losing the back end on the exit of turn 14 and slides the bike down. How he actually lost the back end, I don't exactly know, because I never did see like a good camera angle to figure out how he lost it. But he slides the bike off into the gravel trap. And then Kornfeld is directly behind him. With no place to go, Kornfeld jumps his bike supercross style off of Bastianini's downed bike, flies through the air, lands in the gravel trap, both feet still on the pegs, somehow manages to stay upright on the bike, saves it, rides back onto the extra pavement there beyond the curbing on the front stretch, and is cool enough and has enough presence of mind to look over his right shoulder to make sure that it was okay for him to actually join the traffic on the front stretch. Absolutely, without a doubt, save of the year.
Yeah, you didn't think he had any chance of saving it. And then he just like hops up, bunny hops it, keeps going. He made it look smooth. It was good. It was very good. I mean, it's been getting a ton of social media play. It's been on like news outlets and stuff too. It's pretty nuts.
Pretty crazy. Then we go into the last lap. We get back around to turn 10. We're running to turn 11. Now, DG Antonio is right there with Martin and Bezecchi. Well, at turn 11, DG Antonio puts a hard move on Martin and boxes him out with a nice, sharp block pass. Martin then now is third. Bezecchi seems like he's got this. But as we go through the turn 12 and head to 13, DG Antonio just decides to just go demon late on the brakes. Outbrakes Bezecchi and comes up the inside of it. It's a fair, clean pass by DG Antonio. He's now leading the race. But Bezecchi kind of thinks that Martin's going to come with DG Antonio, so he tries to get back onto the gas. When he does, the bike steps out, high sides Bezecchi, and lo and behold, Martin, with nowhere to go, winds up ramming into the back of his bike. So both Martin and Bezecchi are both down on the ground. DG Antonio scoots off to the wind, and the rest of the pack comes flying on through. So you think that was absolutely amazing, and you have another crash here at the very end of it. To me, what I don't get is where Martin's head was. His bike wasn't badly damaged because they just sort of fell off. When Bacciucci fell down, he came down on his knees and it looked hard. So he had hopped right back up, but then sort of like the adrenaline wore off and then the pain started to come into him. So he wasn't really doing anything with his bike. But I can't believe that Martin didn't try to at least push his bike across the line to get a few more points. I don't know what he was thinking there, because the finish line at Le Mans is not that far removed from the last turn. So he could have easily had made it there. I don't know if he was just upset with himself, upset with Bezzecchi, or what he was thinking, but he didn't do anything and I just expected him to.
It's tough to sometimes get your composure after that, I can imagine. I mean, like, I don't know. I don't think you should, you know, harsh on him for not getting it across the line. The interesting thing is two races in a row he has DNF. Two races in a row, it's not mm-hmm. his fault. But there's yep. no doubt in my mind that he's still going to win this championship. Unlike, you know, MotoGP, while Bezzecchi is doing solid, Martin just seems like he's in control. And he just needs to make sure he's not in these, like, tricky situations that Moto3 can put you in. But there's still a lot of racing, and unless he gets injured, unfortunately he has known to be, there's no doubt that he's going to take this title.
That's the thing I'm thinking from my perspective. These titles come down to winning it by like 1 or 2 points, and just having gotten a few more points could be the difference at the end of the season for him.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, you can make that case in any class, right? But
sure.
I mean, you look at the last couple of years in Moto3, right? You have Mir. You have Binder, you have Kent. Like, those guys, I mean, besides Kent, Kent did have a huge advantage, but he kind of blew that for himself. But, you know, they've had pretty hefty leads. So I think, obviously, it's going to take some reversal of fortune, some bad luck for Bezzecchi, for Kennett, you know, for some of the other riders. But I can't see Martin, just with the form he has, that he's really out of it. You know, two DNFs in a season is a hard way to win a championship, but there's not a single part of me that feels like he's out of it.
Definitely not. DG Antonio celebrates a victory. He actually is leading the championship. As they crossed the line, it was DG Antonio followed by Arenas, Mino, and Ramirez. That's how they came across. Well, timing and scoring then showed that DG Antonio was going to get a penalty of 3 seconds for exceeding track limits. So as they come back around, who starts celebrating but Arenas? Because he now realizes, and so does his team, his Angelo Nieto team, realize that they've got the time penalty, that they've actually won the race. When DG Antonio finally makes it into the pits, he's actually confronted and told that he actually has his penalty, and that poor kid was so dejected. You could just see the emotion pour out of him as he got off the bike and he walked back down the pit lane. Absolutely stunning images. I mean, I think that's what sport's all about, is the highs of the greatest high of highs that suddenly became the greatest low of lows that happened right there. That's racing, and it's what happens. Again, I'll go to the soapbox because I can. I saw one replay that I believe is where DG Antonio actually cut the track. It was earlier on. Kornfeld had actually sort of helped sit him up a little bit, and then he ran past the chicane and cut the corner. He then dropped himself back into line, but he did pass Kornfeld in the process. So by doing that, did he deserve a time penalty? Yep, I think he did. He did cut the track, and he did not fall back in behind the man that he was chasing, which was Kornfeld. However, Kornfeld did help him go out there. Did he deserve the penalty? Long story short, yes, I think he did. Is it heartbreaking? Very, very much so. But I guess that's what racing is all about. So the corrected finish then is Arenas with the victory, Mino finishing second. So it's a 1-2 for the Angelo Nieto team. Then Ramirez, DG Antonio with the time penalty then becomes fourth. Antonelli's fifth. Kornfeld with his time penalty winds up finishing sixth. And plus surviving the Evel Knievel Grand Canyon jump as well. And then Arbolino is in seventh. Kennett had rode his way up to actually eighth. And then Tatsuki Suzuki is ninth. And Masia is a 10th. And that's how Moto3 finishes. A wild finish to a wild race.
Exactly. Yeah, it was pretty nuts. Moto2, on the other hand, was the opposite. Not all that exciting, which is unfortunate because I think, at least this year, Moto2 is one of the one of the most exciting championships. But yeah, not, it didn't go quite that way.
It did have some drama in it, I will admit to that. The drama starts at the beginning as they line up. Chave Verge isn't in his space. He's actually still in the pits and they're working on his bike. Come to find out, they actually had a fuel pump failure and had to replace the fuel tank, so he was going to have to start from the back of the grid. Since all that work was done after the siding lap, he was able to then leave pit lane when the bikes went on the warm-up lap, and then he started essentially 35th on the grid to start the race. At the beginning of the race, basically, Benyaya is basically out front. Marquez makes a blinding start to kind of get there and go with him. After that, basically, Baldessari kind of goes backwards a little bit. Mir works his way up, and he's going forward in there to get to third place in the podium. Everybody basically just spreads out, and no one really goes anywhere. Your attention is focused towards Verge, starting from the back of the pack, and he just rides the wheels off of that Kalex to run himself all the way up to fifth, which was very impressive for him to have done. It was another impressive ride by Marcel Schroeder, which I think fourth is his best ever finish in the Moto2 class, even with the broken scaphoid. And then you have Miguel Oliveira, as always, the steady man for KTM, coming home in sixth position. Fanati had a good ride. Quartararo was eighth. Bender's ninth. And Manzi finishes 10th. It was not the usual Moto2 race that we are used to seeing. Basically, Benyaya had everybody covered.
Yeah, I mean, the most impressive thing was the ride by Chavi. It was insane to watch coming through the Dunlop chicane and then down into La Chapelle. That was insane how he was manhandling that bike. He was going around the outside of riders, diving down the inside. That was amazing. Pecco definitely deserved the win. From the off, he was the guy to beat. But yeah, seeing Mir on the podium, it's actually a little surprising it's taken him this long. He definitely should have been on the podium in Austin, but super impressive. Again, I think why he doesn't need so much time to develop if he can sleep at night not having that that Moto2 World Championship, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you really could be looking for the good to come out of it. I think Marquez had a good ride. He kept Bagnaia honest, although Bagnaia definitely had the pace, and I don't think Marquez had it. I think he was at the limit or darn near over it to sort of keep up.
Yeah, you saw them like trading lap times and stuff kind of in the early parts of the race, and you could see Marquez was really, really pushing to try to stay with that lap time. And it was just only going to be a matter of time until he burnt out that tire. So after DNF last time out, to go away with 20 points, I think he was happy to take it.
I completely agree with you on that one. Again, the KTMs seem to be lost at sea a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know what's up with that. I mean, maybe these tracks just don't... Well, Le Mans has never suited the KTM in the years that they've been there, which is not that many.
Yeah, I mean, it was just last year, and it was really early, but, you know, it was just kind of a reassurance that they still had an issue. Did Sam Lowes didn't crash during the race. He just ended up crashing during qualifying.
Mm-hmm. He did stay on two wheels, and he finished 13th. The crash was Roberts. He crashed on the NTS, which hurt.
Yeah, that was disappointing. There's obviously progress being made. He just needs to bring it home now. But yeah, Danny Kent down 21st. That was also shocking, especially because Quartararo was already up in eighth. So the speed up, you know, can work well here. Shout out to Nicky Tooley, first ride on the Moto2 bike, 22nd. Not a bad start with the Sick Racing team. Yeah, that pretty much summed it up with Moto2.
So let's go on to the MotoGP race. How about that?
Let's.
So the MotoGP race. The big news to begin with is that Crutchlow will actually race. He basically had x-rays at the hospital. They found no broken bones or anything. He was just extremely sore, but he took that big of a hit, got on a 270 horsepower bucking Bronco that tried to kill him the day before and decided to race with it, which I personally would have to be seeing a psychologist and resting in bed for a month. But that is what drives these guys, and it's why I talk about it and why they do it. But I think one of the interesting things we need to look at after that is the tires that everybody was on, because I think tires are crucial at Le Mans. So quickly, Zarco had a medium on the front, had a soft rear. Marquez had a medium on the front, but a hard rear. He was the only person to choose a hard rear. Petrucci had soft, Iannone had medium soft. Dovi had medium soft. Lorenzo went soft soft like Petrucci. Rossi went with a medium and a soft, and then Vinales had soft soft. Marquez had put down some serious pace in the morning warm-up on a hard rear, so tires was going to be an issue. Zarco actually had a bad start. Lorenzo had a great one because Lorenzo came through to lead there. He led into the chicane at the start, but Zarco sat up Marquez big time in that chicane. He went deep and nailed it, and a hard, aggressive move because he knew Lorenzo was going to get out on him, and Zarco didn't want to see that happen. So that kind of pushed Marquez back in the pack a little bit as they got over the top of the hill and headed to La Chapelle. Iannone went down on the Suzuki, just lost the front. Well, when he went down, Marquez didn't know exactly where he was going to go, so Marquez kind of sat up to try to figure out where Iannone was going to spin off at, and that cost Marquez a little bit more time, so that dropped him back again. So by the time we had gotten through the first few turns and hit the backstretch, it was Lorenzo followed by Zarco. Dovi had now made his way to third. Then it was Petrucci, then Rossi, and then Marquez. Then we had Lorenzo, Dovi, and Zarco, who makes a small mistake at La Chapelle. Vinales had fallen all the way down to 13th, but it was starting to shape up to be like one of those ding-dong battles, and it was looked to be almost like a repeat of Jerez, because you had Lorenzo out front. He's sort of on a track that he can kind of pole putt, to use dirt track parlance, where he can just stay to that inside line and can accelerate, out accelerate anybody, and can just, you know, hey, if you're going to get by me, you're going to have to force your way by me. So Dovi then tried to take a run at the front, and going into La Chapelle, he came out of chicane, went over the hill crest there. He got the bike a little squirrely. You know, he said that he was in there a little deep on the front, tried to back the back end in to help the bike turn, lost the front, and slid out. So it was like, wow, there's Marquez's main championship rival already on the ground, and we were maybe three or four laps into the race when that happened.
Yeah, I saw him make the move on Lorenzo cleanly into the chicane, and I was like, good. I went to grab my coffee. I looked down, and I was watching the race with my dad, and he just like yells at the screen. I'm like, oh my god, what happened? And my heart just sunk. I was like so devastated. And you saw Dovizioso. He was in the gravel. Like, what just happened? He had no idea why he crashed either.
Yeah, I've had that experience. I've rolled through a gravel trap before and rolled up and go, well, how did I get here? And I can sympathize with Dovizioso on that one. I know what he was feeling. Dovizioso had some pace. He had a good shot at winning the race, and he really couldn't explain the crash other than, you know, just the front end kind of folded in on him a little bit.
But yeah, I think it just kind of goes back to the crash fest of Le Mans this weekend. You know, whatever grip the track is offering was limited. And just really caused that front end to tuck a bunch.
Marquez had basically used that incident with Dovizioso to sort of kind of catch up a little bit. So it was Lorenzo, Zarco, and Marquez. They were in a pack. Marquez then kind of tried, put a very nice move on Zarco to kind of go to second. But then Zarco put it right back on him again at the Dunlap chicane. And you could see that Lorenzo was basically backing everybody up, because Petrucci, Rossi, Miller, they all sort of caught the train. Not sure if that played into what happens next, but maybe it did, because as we get to turn 8, Zarco just folded the front and off he went into the gravel trap. It was an interesting crash. He was in there deep, just folded the front, a typical crash that it seems like everybody was having all weekend long. But if you watch the crash in the slow motion from the inside of the track, you can see Zarco actually is leaned over, everything seems to be smooth, and the front end goes so quick that it actually takes his right hand off of the throttle, and he actually bounces his right hand onto the track and then picks his right hand up and puts it back onto the hand grip to try to get some more throttle to save the bike, but he can't and winds up continuing on into the gravel trap. I mean, that's just the thinking that these guys have, that in that millisecond of my hand isn't there, I'm going to put it back on and try to save it again, which is really kind of amazing, the brain power that Zarco had to go through that. Did he get his board showing that they had absolutely no gap to the people who were behind anymore? Did that force his hand and he tried to go a little bit harder and try to get past Lorenzo so that they could do that? And that's why he folded it up. I don't really know, but either way, he was down.
Yeah, again, another devastating moment. You know, he's leading his home race, be like, all right, he has the pace, he can push, he can get out front, you know, try to create a gap with Mark, and nope, that was it. And that was kind of the race.
Yeah, because basically Marquez then starts to stalk Lorenzo. It becomes a matter of when, not if. He knew it was going to happen. Lorenzo lets the door open, and then Marquez just rams right through it, and he basically controlled the race from the front. Now, Marquez was without incident. We did have a Marquez moment at the turn three, the first left-hander on the circuit, the chicane. Marquez did lose the front. He just simply put his knee down on his elbow, pushed it back up on center, and took off like nothing else had actually happened to him. But after that, Marquez led basically Petrucci, Lorenzo, and Rossi and Miller. Rossi went to third, but Petrucci was keeping Miller honest. So Rossi pulled off some more Rossi magic to actually come home in third. Aleix Espargaró finished seventh on the Aprilia, which I thought was an amazing ride for Aleix. He was definitely there. Miller faded off of Rossi at the very end, and then Crutchlow went bravely past Rins at turn one. And the race finishes off with Marquez winning. Petrucci was second, Rossi in third. Petrucci making a statement that maybe he should get the factory Ducati ride next year. Miller was in fourth, vindicating maybe the fact that he needs GP19 and maintains favored son status with David Tardozzi. Pedrosa then comes home in fifth. Lorenzo with the soft front tire wound up finishing in sixth. Vinales was seventh. Crutchlow there. Espargaró wound up finishing ninth. He was up to seventh in the race, I guess is how I should have said, and then fell backwards. And that is how the top 10 went.
Yeah, it was almost an interesting race. How the recipes to be a super fascinating MotoGP classic. A lot of guys with the same race pace. Had Dovi get out in front. Had Zarco, you know, on pole for his home Grand Prix, and it just turned out to be another one of the Marquez runaways. So we'll see what happens in Agello. You know, seemed to be a tricky track for a lot of the Hondas before, but that was largely due to the acceleration issue. So with that not being there, we'll probably see Mark closer to the front again. We know the Ducatis are strong there, so it's you know, that one's going to be interesting too.
Mm-hmm. I think we should recap all of the point standings in the championship, because it did kind of shake things up a little bit, and we didn't do that earlier. So the Moto3 championship, let's go all the way back to that. Bacecchi, he still stays on top of the Moto3 championship with 63 points. DG Antonio is there at 59. Canet at 56. Martin falls to fourth on 55. So, you know, we're talking like an 8-point difference there. That's definitely nothing. Minho's fifth. Ramirez sixth. Antonelli seventh. Ortel eighth. Kornfeld is ninth. And Bastianini is 10th. Bastianini's chances at being 30-some points behind looking a little bit slim there. Into the Moto2 point standings after the race, what we would expect, Bagnaia out front on 98 points. Oliveira with the KTM is now at 73. So that puts him exactly one race win behind there. So anything can happen. Still all to play for. Marquez at 67 in third. Baldessari's fourth. Pessini fifth. Xavi Verhey in sixth. Juan Mir in 7th, Marcel Schroeder in 8th. Good riding from him has kept him in the points. And then Brad Binder in 9th, and Lucchione there in 10th. The MotoGP stars, their championship standings, as we would expect, Marc Marquez out front on 95 points. It's beginning to look a lot like 2014. I know we've said it before, but this one's really starting to look like 2014 because all of Marquez's closest rivals all seem to be falling off at inappropriate times, much like they did in 2014, and Marquez simply is just winning races and taking the championship by storm right now. He definitely has a firm grasp on it at this point. His nearest rival is now Maverick Vinales due to Dovi's non-finish, so he's on 59 points, so quite a gap there. Zarco is in third on 58, Valentino Rossi fourth, Petrucci fifth, Miller sixth, Iannone seventh, Crutchlow eighth, Dovizioso 9th, and then Pedrosa 10th, and that's how the standings are. Derek, Mugello is next with the big, long, super fast straightaways and the fastest top speed in all of MotoGP. Tell me who your podium is.
I want to put Davi on the top step again, but we'll see if he can finish race this week. Mark is going to be on the podium. If not, take the win. He's going to be second. I want to say Lorenzo, but he's going to burn that tire too fast. If Petrucci has a good ride and he's going to be a threat for the podium, 100% on Davi and Mark. I'm going with 50 per, 60% on Petrucci up there with a wild card of a Rossi.
Interesting. I'm going to put Dovizioso on the top step. I just think Dovizioso is due. He won at Mugello last year, didn't he? I believe he did. Marquez will be second, and I will put Jack Miller on the podium in third.
I'd love to see Jack on the podium. I don't think he's there. I don't think he has the pace. And I think we're getting to the point in the season where the satellite bikes, you know, they're still on last year's hardware, whereas the factory bikes are starting to get some updates. So we start to see that gap get a little bit bigger, but anything can happen. Jack's already won a GP, so we'll see.
Hey, what if it rains? Miller could win the whole thing. We know he's good in the rain.
That's very true. That's very true.
So I think that pretty much wraps it up for us on this part of it. We are going to Mugello next. That is the next race in the MotoGP calendar. If you guys like the show, if you could leave us a review, that'd be really great. Appreciate it very much if you would. If you want to get in contact with us, you can simply send us an email at motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all the hosts, and somebody will get back to you with an answer to your question or your comments, and we appreciate your feedback in that method too. If you can make a donation, that'd be great. Just go to motopodcast.com, left-hand side of the page, and find the PayPal or the Patreon links. If you want to talk to me directly, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MotoRGV. Derek, where can the people find you?
People can find me at MotoDerekC on any form of social media you want, mainly Instagram and Twitter.
All right, then. For Derek and myself, that's it. We will talk to you guys after Mugello. Cheers.